Welcome to the No One Fights Alone podcast. This podcast is dedicated to mental wellness for first responders and beyond. Through powerful stories, personal experiences, and expert insights, we explore the challenges and triumphs of maintaining resilience in the face of adversity. Together, we remind you, no one fights alone.
Max, buddy, how are you, man?
Good, man. How was it going?
Oh, good. Feels like I just talked to you. Oh, wait, I did. We just did our group this morning.
We did.
Yeah.
Very good group.
Man, I'm looking forward to seeing you next week, coming up next week. I know timeline-wise, when we release this, it'll be later, but Max and I don't get to see each other very often in person, and next week we'll be in the same. Everybody better watch out in Utah.
That's right. It's going to be cold.
I'm super excited about our guest today, Deborah, as her mom calls her, Green. Debbie Green, 28-year communications, is here to tell us her story of pain and suffering, and then moving to health and life. Debbie, welcome to the No One Fights Alone podcast.
Hi, how are you?
Oh, we're doing great. How are you?
I am wonderful today.
Coming to us from Rancho Cordo, California. Cordova. Did I get Rancho, that? Cordova.
Rancho Cordova.
Rancho Cordova, California. How's everything in California?
Up here, it's great. Southern California, not so much.
Yeah, well,
We've got some of the smoke from those fires in LA, and makes for some beautiful sunsets, even though there's death and destruction down south. So
yeah. Hearts and prayers to everyone in the Southern California fires. But you're in, just for perspective, you're up on the outskirts of Sacramento area in Northern California.
Yes.
Beautiful country.
I love it. Yeah.
Of course. Well, Debbie, let's take us on a little bit of a journey. I know you've got a really amazing story that we can't wait to dive into. So start us off. How did you even get into this communication? Let's start there.
Oh my gosh. Well, 1986, I was 19 and silly and joined the California National Guard, became a communication specialist. My main objective was becoming military police, but at the time I was too short, but there was a loophole. If you went in under one MOS, you could transfer without height requirements to another MOS. So,
MOS, so that was military police.
I went into military police later in my career. My one and only deployment was to the LA riots back in 1992.
Yep.
And prior to that, I had already become a dispatcher. I was going through the dispatch academy with Sacramento Police Department at the time of the deployment. So I didn't quite graduate with them. I kind of put it on hold, went to the LA riots, and then came back and finished up the academy.
Oh, I love that. Well, 28 years in communications. If you were to sum up 28 years in just a word or a phrase, what would that be?
Oh my gosh. I don't know about a word or a phrase. It was holy hell. What a ride.
Pretty crazy.
You know, I mean, you have your ups, your downs, your, you know, critical incidents, your funny stuff. I mean, it's just kind of all wrapped into one big, I really loved what I did. It was a wonderful job.
Well, before we go into, and I know you have a story to tell here, but before we go in, the challenge of communications, and I know, you know, for the longest time, I think there's a trend toward accepting, but for the longest time, communications dispatch was not accepted as part of the first responder community, and which didn't make sense. It doesn't make sense. You're with us and you know, along this journey.
Well, and we're the first responders. We're there. You're calling us. We pick up the phone. We are there immediately. It's, you know, so not a lot of people understand that.
So expound on that. What are some of the challenges if we have listeners who maybe are not as well versed in understanding all the nuances and challenges of communications? Walk us through a little bit of all, you know, some of those things.
So in a nutshell, the job is you take a phone call, whether it's 911 or a non-emergency line. You take the information from the caller, you put it into your CAD system, which is computer-aided dispatch. That call goes to the radio dispatcher, and law enforcement or fire medics are dispatched to respond. That's it in a nutshell. The challenges are every single call is different. So you could be on a call with a little kid that's grabbed mom's phone and accidentally dialed 911. And that's a good call. It's, you know, you're trying to get mom on the phone and all of that. Once that's settled and done, you're picking up that next call and you have a shooting. I mean, it's just that quick as far as how you change your perspective, how you change how you're dealing with the call, and also how you're dealing with the call mentally. So you're going from highs to lows really quick. So and to put it in a bigger perspective, my busiest shift with my first agency, I took 100 phone calls or entered 100 calls for service in 8 hours. Whereas your person on the street, he may do 10, 11, 12, maybe on a busy night, maybe 13, you know, depending on what type of calls. So we're dealing with this, and the ups and downs that we're going through are a lot in a very compressed time period. So nobody realizes the amount of trauma that we go through in a shift, you know. So, and it depends on, you know, and it all depends on what agency you're with, or you know, what if you're rural as opposed to urban. It's all different, but you know, in a nutshell, that's what we're doing. We're going through all of this in a very compressed amount of time.
So Deborah, what is your emotional investment in these types of calls? I mean, the smaller ones, there's not a huge investment, obviously, or animal call or whatever comes in, but what is the emotional investment in these, in a shooting or some of these other high stress calls?
In the beginning, it was hard, you know, when you're in the first couple years that you're doing this, it's really hard to try and process all of that. But as time went on, I can see a lot of disassociating with what was going on, you know, kind of like you became another person almost. If that makes any sense, you kind of shoved it in the back of your head and you went on to the next call. But in the beginning, it was a very hard to process. And mind you, mental health care wasn't a thing back in the 90s.
Right. Yeah. Well, Debbie, with that being said, and I certainly want to honor your time, but you have a story to tell. And I know you have many. But one specifically that has really impacted you. Let's take us on a little bit of a journey on that one.
Okay. Let's see. So October 23rd, 2019, about midnight, 12:30, 1 o'clock. Because it's so traumatic, because there was such a trauma related, I'm not, time was kind of weird. We received a phone call from a person who had a marijuana grow that wanted to report some suspicious subjects in his grow. 2019, California, I believe, still had a 12 or 24 plant maximum that you could personally grow. So that's what we were assuming. He had a grow, his personal grow, and people were coming to steal it. October is harvest season. So, you know, it would be normal for that kind of us to get that kind of call. So I sent out 3 deputies because of where it was at. If anything had happened, it would have taken a long time to get people out there. So I made sure to send extra. They got out there, they talked to the caller, they went out back to go check what was going on, and they were fired upon. Basically an ambush. And during that firefight, I lost one deputy.
Brian.
Yeah, Brian Ishmael. And I didn't know he had passed. Basically, you're going through all your procedures when you have an officer-involved shooting. So you're getting people out there. I had a lot that I was focusing on. We tried to raise him on the radio, and he wouldn't come up on the radio. We weren't sure if he was in a position where he couldn't talk. So we were asking him to click his mic. We were getting nothing. So I sent out everybody. I had a neighboring county that could have gotten there quicker where he was located at. So we were calling for backup from that county. We were sending fire, ambulance, everybody was going to this. I did hear from them while they were out there that they had gotten him into the ambulance. So at that time, I just kind of put it at the back of my mind and said, okay, he's in the ambulance. He will be fine. We're going to get him to the hospital. We're all good. And I continued on with what we were going, what we were doing right then, which was getting those suspects in custody.
And a lot's happened right here. What you just unpacked, a lot has happened.
Yes.
When something like this tragedy, something like this tragic happens, what happens in that environment of a communications center or arena? What happens?
There's a lot going on. Right? So in our center, we did double duty as far as phone calls and radio. But because I was working what we called the busy radio at the time, I was the last to answer any phone calls. But when you have this sort of incident go on, everybody around has a job that they need to do. So we have a procedure that we go through when we have this type of event. As far as call outs, we have to call in admin. We have to call all the department heads, the captains, everybody to get SWAT team out there, detectives out there, you name it. Call in people early to cover shifts for the rest of the county. We've got other agencies coming in. So we had our units from Tahoe coming down. We had, when you have this type of shooting also, your department is not responsible for doing the investigative work. So we had representatives from CHP, South Lake Tahoe Police Department, Placerville Police Department, and also the DA's office. And there's a group of them that would do the actual investigation on the shooting. So it wouldn't come, so that it wouldn't be like a conflict of interest on this type of thing. So all of this stuff is going on behind me at the time. You know, phone calls are being made. People are coming in. The chaplains were called in. Peer support was called in. But I'm still concentrating on this one incident. But it's just a madhouse behind me, basically. I'm just, calling out stuff that I need and I get it done. What I need is being done. So there's a lot of work that goes into that.
And at the same time, you're still getting other calls. I mean, somebody's answering this, this is just this crazy environment of communications is, oh, by the way, there's still other shit going on.
Oh, yeah. So when you have this type of, our county was over 100 miles long. So stuff is going on in Tahoe that they're not realizing that we've got a shooting going on. and there's stuff going on the West End. And so it was just, it's a lot going on at the time. So you're trying to concentrate. And my job was to keep these guys calm and focused on what they were doing, and get that mission accomplished.
Okay. Thanks for letting me chase that rabbit. Okay. So we've got all this going on.
Right.
Let's get back to, you know, kind of your perspective here.
So in the middle of all of this, because it took about 3 hours for us to get that second suspect. But in the middle of all of this, somebody who was at the hospital saw that they had brought him in and that he had passed, and they posted this on Facebook.
Ugh.
And I don't know. Luckily, our patrol lieutenant was there, and he saw this and called up to let us know that Brian had passed so that we didn't read it on Facebook first.
Mm-hmm.
So my lead at the time, she came over and she goes, "I don't know how to tell you this. It needs to be said." And she told me that he had passed. So I'm sobbing.
Sure, of course.
Trying to keep these guys on focus to get their job done. And so I'm listening to this. I'm crying. Every time I had to make a transmission, I would take a deep breath, calm myself just that little bit, get that transmission done, and then go back to crying again, you know, and just getting it done, because there was nobody there to take over. You know, we were right. All upset. We were all, you know, it wasn't just me. And yeah, it was very difficult. yeah.
So Deborah, what was that time frame like from the time that he showed up on scene to the time that you were notified that there were shots fired, and then at the hospital, and then you were notified of his passing?
So let's see. To the best of my recollection, so I believe the phone call came in about 12:30, the original call. We dispatched it. I went on a break to go, you know, just, we got to get up and move around. Did a walk and came back. And on my way back, my lead had said, "You need to get back in here right away." So it was somewhere, I'm thinking about 1 o'clock, because it took them a while to get out there and organize. So I'm thinking the original shots fired were about 1 o'clock in the morning. And from what I understand, he passed at 1:30, or that's when, you know, they found him. And then one suspect was taken into custody, and the second suspect was taken in at 4:30 in the morning. So I have 3 hours of this.
And after you found out, after you got the call from, I think you said the lieutenant that he had passed, how do you stay at work and still deal with that stuff? You said there's other calls coming in. I mean, what was the environment in your dispatch center because you have to keep doing the work, but were you allowed to take a break? Were you allowed to get together with your coworkers at all?
So much going on. Let me think. 1, 2, 3, 4. There were 5 of us. Of the 5 of us, I was working the incident on the radio. Another person took over the channel. We moved everybody else not involved in the incident onto another channel. So we had that radio dispatcher. Then we had to have a radio dispatcher for Tahoe. So we had 3 of us out of 5 on a radio, and 2 call takers. So even though, and we were doing double duty, so those gals that were working the radios were also making phone calls. So we can't call in at the time. We weren't able to call in people for backup, until we got authorization. Once the undersheriff came in, he authorized us to call in for backup and get people in to come take over for us. I didn't relinquish my radio until that second suspect was caught, though. You know, you just have a loyalty or responsibility to keep it consistent out there and not have multiple dispatchers if you can help it. So during that whole time, nobody took breaks. We were all just, it was a constant, just working on this.
And what an absolute horrible tragedy. And understandably, you find yourself in this sobbing space. And I do want to circle back to that because there's some things that I would like to maybe pick your brain about. But let's keep going through the actual what happened. So you're notified. He's mm-hmm. he's been killed. He's dead. He's
right.
passed. And we still have this thing working. What's Debbie got going on?
In my brain? A lot of confusion. I mean, sure. You know, I just wanted to, you go into that fight or flight and you got to suppress it. You really do. And that's what I did. I just shoved it down until this whole thing was over.
Sure.
I've got to keep those guys that are listening to me calm and focused.
Of course.
And got a job to do. That's what I did. Nobody knew he had passed until afterwards.
So let's fast forward a little bit, Debbie. You're now off duty and you're going home.
There was a lot more before that.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Walk us through it.
Okay. Yeah. So 4:30, my relief was standing behind me. She was kind of waiting for me. And I said, you know, hold on. We haven't gotten this second guy yet. Once we got the second guy, I said, okay, whenever you're ready, you can have him. I walked out of the dispatch center and down the hall. We were brand new in this building. We had just gotten in our new building and hadn't even been a week yet. So I had stairwells, which was nice. I went down, sat in the stairwell and cried for about a half an hour. And then got up and I was just kind of, I needed to make a couple phone calls to people to let them know what happened. People who were no longer in the department, but were like a support system for me. So I made those phone calls. By the time I was out, going out the front doors, peer support was already there in full force and also the chaplaincy. So we had people and, you know, I was walking down there, somebody was with me that whole time of just walking with me. I was making phone calls and things like that. And then about, oh gosh, it was about 5:30. Somebody said, you need to call home and let them know what happened. And I, you know, I'm kind of looking, I'm going, yeah, no, Mr. Green doesn't get up this early. I want him in a space where, you know, he's awake and he can deal with me. So we waited a little bit for that. But about, oh my gosh, it must've been like 6 o'clock, 5:30, 6 o'clock, 6 o'clock, 6:30. Oh my gosh. The time, it just seemed a blur. We had a peer support person that brought all the dispatchers into a stress debrief. So your initial stress, critical stress debrief that you get afterwards. Then after that, we were part of the procession taking, Brian's body down to Sacramento for autopsy. That was an amazing, now, mind you, this happened. He was killed at 1:30. Our incident went on, for the most part, the rest of the day, but I mean, till 4:30 was when it was in cleanup phase rather than active shooter phase. And when we drove down, we were on the freeway, maybe 7 o'clock going down to Sacramento, which is a 20 plus mile drive. There were cars lining the freeway the whole way down. There were cars in fire departments on overpasses. And this is how focused I was. I didn't realize everything that was going on. You know, once you have a shooting, there's a machine that starts and there's a mm-hmm. process and you don't, you know, being me, I was just so focused. I didn't realize what exactly was going on. So, that was quite impressive, to say the least. And then, somebody drove me back up to Placerville and, I got my car, drove home. I think I got home about 11:30 that morning. So I had been up since 4:30 the day before. So I was exhausted. When I got home, I immediately made an appointment for a mental health, emergency mental health appointment for the next day. And then, the days after we had appointments, you know, at work for critical incident management and stuff. So, but that was a long night, very long night.
So how did your telling your husband go? How did that conversation go?
Through a lot of tears. He understood what was going on, and I let him know that, you know, I was, you know, have the next day off and stuff. And he went to work because he knew I was going to come home and maybe stay up, but I needed to decompress when I got home. And then I would try to get some sleep. So he just made it so that the house would be quiet for me when I got home, which was awesome. You know, he didn't want to smother me asking questions and stuff like that.
No, I completely get it. So Debbie, one of the things that I think is really important, you know, communications folks and dispatcher folks, fully understand this, but I think it's lost on a little bit of the little translation lost as to how protective the nature of a communications person, how protective they really are. Mm-hmm. And the impact of having lost or having somebody harmed or injured or lost from that perspective or that seat. How big is that?
It's big. They were my kids. I mean, a lot of those deputies were as old as my kids, you know?
Right.
And trying to keep them safe. It was my job to send them home safe to their families every night, every morning.
You know? So then the impact of this.
It was horrible. Yeah.
Yeah.
It was bad. I don't know how to describe it. It was like losing my kid.
Yeah.
And the helplessness I felt is just indescribable. You know, I'm sitting in front of a computer keyboard with a phone, and I'm not out there physically helping him. And it's just, and having been on the streets too, you know, I also had that perspective of being able to help in person, but now I'm totally helpless as far as helping that person. I wasn't able to get out there and pull him out of that hole that he was in and get him into the ambulance. I wasn't able to return fire with a gun. I was just able to sit at my keyboard and call people and get people out there to try and help him. I don't know how else to describe it. It's just, yeah.
So Deborah, after the incident, how did this impact your life after this? And like, what changes came to your life after this incident?
So a lot of the immediate trauma responses, I guess you would call it. I had a lot of anger issues. Was very angry for a very long time. Crying on the way home, crying on the way to work. In 2016 or 2015, I had had open heart surgery, and 6 months later, I started on a mental health journey then. So I had in place a support group that I was attending weekly. I had a therapist. I knew I had taken mental health classes, so I knew how to cope. I just didn't actively use it on a trauma until that very moment. I knew I had to get an emergency therapy appointment. I used my peer support as much as I could. And for this next year, I had a supervisor who was not trauma-informed and took me down a disciplinary route rather than helping me. If that makes any sense, because I was horrible.
Yeah. Now, let's kind of pause you there. When you say I was horrible, I think a lot of people understand that, but let's put some more context to that. I was horrible is what? Disagreeable, cantankerous, calling in sick. I mean, what does that look like?
Oh, I didn't. I had been on what we called, an FMLA where if I needed to, I could call in sick, and it wasn't. So I wasn't calling in sick, but my anger was on a trigger. It was just very, I was very angry and had I would snap at anybody. But I wasn't realizing it at the time. Because I was trying to hold myself together.
Sure.
Made mistakes at work, yelled at supervisors, but nobody took the time to say, hey, there's something wrong. We need to figure out what's going on with this person. It was more reactionary and taking me, you know, I was written up so many times that next year it wasn't even funny.
Did you know when this was happening? Did you have some idea of the origin of this behavior?
Yes.
I mean, because
it started that night.
Sure. Yeah.
And how did that carry over into home? I mean, how you were acting at work and your attitude, your demeanor, how was it at home?
My husband was really, really good, and he was very supportive of me getting help. So, you know, he would just kind of say, hey, do you need to call your therapist? Or just kind of giving me the space to try to deal with what was going on. I mean, it wasn't bad. I had some arguments with my children and you know, it was tough. I think my healing process didn't start until after a year later.
Was there a catalyst for that? Was there
yes.
Walk us through that a little bit.
So I had a supervisor that was going to college to be a therapist, which was great. And she saw the signs. And so she got me on workman's comp and got me, I was seeing a psychiatrist through workman's comp and got signed off of work. And basically that's what it was as soon as I got off work is when I was able to start the healing and not having all those stressors. Dealing with work, having to be that same person at work and breaking down inside. So, you know, I started doing a lot better as soon as I was off work.
So let's expound on that a little bit. So you start going to a mental health professional.
Right.
And how was that? Was there some resistance to that? I mean, it sounds like you are already embracing this wellness aspect.
Right.
But it's a difficult process to start digging out some of these really core emotions and traumas. Walk us through that a little bit.
She put me on light duty, and with dispatch, there's no such thing as light duty, other than 40 hours a week. And then she finally signed me out. So I'm on workman's comp. I'm talking to her. My biggest argument with her signing me out was, you're taking me from a situation where I can be around people and be helpful to people to putting me in a box by myself in my own head. And it's like, what are we going to do with that? And then, mind you, this was still during COVID restrictions. So I couldn't go walk around the mall. I couldn't go, you know, do normal things like normal people would do before that. It was sit at home and do nothing. So what I did was I put myself on a schedule. I had come off of 20 plus years on graveyard. So I was up every day at 8. I was out taking a walk outside. I started listening to podcasts, mental health podcasts and stuff, but it seemed to stress me out more. So I kind of went and listened to other things that weren't law enforcement or mental health related, which seemed to help. And just getting outside and walking. I have a to-do list that I do every day. You know, let's find a day that we do laundry. Let's find, you know, just something to keep me busy all day. Cleaning. I was working on my hobbies. Let's see. December of 2020, the Deputy Sheriff's Association got a scholarship for me to go to a trauma retreat, which was for 4 days, which was fabulous, where I learned some more coping techniques and other, I was exposed to brain spotting, which is similar to EMDR, and how to use, you know, massage therapy and other things like that to help with my trauma recovery.
Now, this was West Coast Trauma.
No, it was called the Bridges Retreat. It was actually in El Dorado County. Yeah. They're no longer together, but I went there with 4 Cal firefighters and a police officer from another agency, and it was great, you know, and having people there that had traumas, maybe not exactly like I had, but traumas, and they were first responders, so they got what I was going through.
Well, the one of the many things that often comes about from a trauma retreat is you know, there's some really great things that derive from attending one of those. But one of them is that you are connected with people that help you feel like you're not the only person experiencing them. Is that true for you?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, even though there's thousands of dispatchers in this country, in the world, I didn't feel like there was somebody out there like me. And I didn't know who to go to. Luckily, I had gone the year before to a critical incident stress management class and met a wonderful person who worked at an agency near me, and her dispatch center was right near where my therapist's office was. So I would go to my therapist and then call her up and ask her if she was working and then go over and see her for another hour. So.
Oh, that's so great. Well, for time purposes, and there's, is there anything that you want to add to the and thank you for sharing and being, I know this is hard. I know this is, it's, but it is really, really important. And thank you so much for being vulnerable and sharing this difficult story. But are there components of this story that you'd like to put in as well that maybe are, that are important to the listeners in this podcast?
Oh my gosh.
I know there's a lot, but
there's a lot. You're not alone. There's lots of us out here. We're just not as vocal as people think. Unlike me, I'm going out and telling my story as much as I can. I want to be that person that I didn't have for my trauma. I want to be that voice that says it's okay. But also to get the mental health treatment that you need and start sure. early. Start day one when you get into this profession, whether you're a cop, whether you're a firefighter, a dispatcher, a medic, even along the lines of emergency room doctors and nurses. When you sign up day one, go start looking for your therapist, your psychiatrist, your psychologist, whoever, and keep going until you find that person that clicks with you. And go see them on a regular basis. Because when the shit hits a fan, pardon my expression.
Sure, no, that's
when great. The shit hits a fan, you want to have somebody there and then. You don't want to have to go looking at that point like I did.
For sure.
I think that's awesome, Deborah. And I love that advice. Explain to us what life looks like now. What is after this incident, after your retirement, today, here, January, whatever we are, 17th of 2025, physically, emotionally, relationship wise, what does life look like for Deborah?
Well, I had this wonderful little boy that was born 1 month before my psychiatrist signed me off of work in 2020. And he and I have been best buddies since October of 2020. He's now 4 and a half, and I watch him every day. Mm-hmm. It's my grandson. He's autistic, so we're learning together. I'm learning to be a little more patient and not so quick to anger. And I've taken classes on speech therapy, and I plan on going to taking some classes on ABA therapy. And I've got this little kid doing amazing things. And so I do that Monday through Friday. And then on the weekends, I'm a receptionist. And just kind of to get me out of the house and earn some real money again. I've got a fabulous boss that doesn't micromanage me. And I go in, I open up a clubhouse, I make coffee, and I sit and answer phones. And I'm still seeing my therapist because the healing journey has not stopped. We're still going forward. And I'm telling my story on podcasts. And it's kind of like a free therapy session every once in a while. So
I absolutely love that. And I love where Max is going with this, because I think conceptually we're talking about, and you just mentioned it, we're talking about growth. You know, from moving forward and moving, you know, you can't change what happened, but you can certainly change how you accept it and receive it and move on. And I know I'm oversimplifying a lot of things, but, you know, some of these truths that you know, well, I'll just draw one out. You found hope in a little boy of this child and a way to pour into instead of somebody taking from you. You were able to pour love and found some semblance of hope, if not in other areas of your life, probably. But what a great example of finding something to positive, yes. to turn your time, effort, energy, and attention to. Is that accurate? Am I close?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. It's been awesome. It's been an awesome journey.
Yeah. Well, Debbie, this has been amazing. This is about right on target. We're finishing up, and you even did a little bit of a wrap up session of right there. I can't tell you how thankful we are to have you on and tell your story. And before I let Max kind of chime in here, I just want to thank you again for clearly, you know, we've hit your emotional button here, and that means you care. That means this is important to you. That means number one, that you're still here and with us and that you care, you know, that's really important. But also thank you for being vulnerable enough just to give us and share us a story that is so near and dear to you. Max, any final thoughts there?
Yeah, no, Deborah, I just, thanks for coming on with us. You know, I will tell you that my view of dispatchers have changed considerably over the several years. In our department that I currently work for, we still, when we have a major incident, we are now including our dispatchers in our debriefs, or you know, that are held a few days afterwards, and that has been absolutely gigantically beneficial for us, for them, and it's really brought a lot of awareness to us out on the road about the struggles that you guys go through. You don't understand how a call ends up, right? I mean, once radio communication's done, then that's the last you hear. And so it's really opened our eyes a lot to what dispatchers really go through. And I think in my department, at least is all I can speak for, is we've started to understand and love our dispatchers even more than before. So I appreciate you being on. I appreciate the hard work you've done for years. And I know you've touched a lot of lives and taken care of a lot of family members, and we love you for that.
Thanks. Debbie, any final thoughts or anything you want to pass on to the listeners before we
we are no longer the suck it up buttercup, and just because you're in therapy doesn't mean you're weak. Just get that done, you know, get out there and take care of your mental health. Whether you think you need it or not, we are not the same people when we retire or get out of this profession than we were when we started. And we need to take a hard look at that and get ourselves healed. And yeah, sorry.
No, that's completely understandable. That's great. If somebody wanted to you know, get a hold of you or connect with you, how can they find Deborah Green?
Well, if you go to Instagram, because that's the most stable right now, I have a link tree. My handle is D911Green in Instagram, and I have a link tree that will hook you up with my LinkedIn and my X. And my TikTok until Sunday, apparently.
Yep.
And after that, I may be going who knows where after that. So, I've started doing kind of like inspirational messages on TikTok, and it's been quite fun and actually helping me out. So I don't get paid for it, but I just go out and, you know, try and make people feel better.
Well, Debbie, I just can't thank you enough for coming on, and I will echo what Max said. I just absolutely love our communications folks. They have a daunting task of caring for our, you know, frontline men and women out there beating the path of protecting them. And I know from experience, I felt it from, you know, some more than others, granted, but, I can feel yours through this podcast. I can tell you care. And it's pretty, that's the norm. I'll just say it. That's the norm for dispatchers communications in this world, and how much they care and protect over us. And Max is right, including them in. This is just a part of our culture now. If it's not, it should be. So Debbie, thank you so much. We'll see you soon.
Thanks, Debbie.
Thanks for having me.
Chateau Health and Wellness is a 16-bed treatment facility nestled in the foothills of the Wasatch Mountains in Midway, Utah. Chateau's First Responder Resiliency Program is designed to treat the unique challenges and issues that first responders encounter in the course of their careers. Chateau's comprehensive and highly individualized approach to treatment addresses more than just the presenting issues. It addresses the why. Each of their seasoned, trauma-trained, and culturally competent therapists utilize evidence-based, specialized therapies to treat trauma at its core and enable clients to begin the healing process while developing a resilient and healthy relationship with stress. Chateau Health and Wellness is trusted by departments and agencies from around the country to treat responders and veterans. In fact, it is one of only a handful of facilities nationwide that is vetted and approved to treat members of the Fraternal Order of Police. For more information or to speak to a representative, go to chateaurecovery.com or call 888-507-5031.